Two of them?
Indeed, Thrawn said. But we have an advantage.
Which is, sir?
The Grists have been studying the Empire, Thrawn said. They must therefore know Imperial ships and weapons. We shall use that knowledge against them.
And hopefully their own cultural blind spots? Pharaoh suggested.
Incoming! Sensor Officer Hammerly called suddenly.
Just out of light speed ahead of us. Configuration. It's the ship we chased out of the Mokivja system, Admiral.
Very good, Thrawn said. Pharaoh's expression holds a degree less uncertainty now. Proceed, Commodore. Let us see how we may turn their numerical advantage against them.
Yes, sir, Pharaoh said.
Her stance still holds tension, but her voice holds only confidence and resolve.
Signal Lord Vader and the Darkhawk, she called toward the comm station. Tell them their target is on the way.
Chimera acknowledged,
Kemond called toward the bridge comm, gazing at the Darkhawk's tactical display. The Grisk ship was headed toward the two drifting ships far ahead, riding a vector that would take them within range of the Imperials lying silent and dark directly in front of them.
Lord Vader, we have target confirmation.
Very well, Commander.
Vader's voice came from the speaker.
Stand ready.
Standing ready, Kemond repeated.
The Grisk ship was getting closer. Overshot the mark. And without warning, the blaze of a TIE Defender's engines flashed into view directly behind the Grisk. The fighter leapt ahead, its laser cannon blasting away at the Grisk's own thrusters. The Grisk was caught completely flat-footed. Vader got a double volley into the thrusters before the pilot belatedly jinked in an effort to throw off his attacker's aim. Too little, too late. Even as the Grisk tried to leap forward, its acceleration faltered and faded away, leaving it running on a locked vector.
Tevin,
Kemond said.
Ready,
the pilot confirmed. She keyed the Darkhawk's thrusters, kicking them to full acceleration. The Grisk shot past. The Darkhawk matched its speed, then started to catch up. The distance between them shrank. Tevin again adjusted her acceleration, and with a violent thud, the Darkhawk slammed against the Grisk, bouncing once against its hatch before the grapples caught and locked the two ships together.
Go!
Kemond shouted. He unstrapped and bounded out of the cockpit, racing toward the hatch. He reached it just as the sizzlers went off, burning through the Grisk's hatch and sending the warped and blackened metal spinning into the enemy ship. It had been one of the fastest breaches Kemond had ever launched. Even so, the Grisks were in position, pressed against walls and in recessed doorways. They opened fire, blasting at Drab and Jid as they crouched inside the partial protection of the Darkhawk's own hatchway. And as the blaze of blaster fire and Grisk lightning guns lit up the corridor, Kemond spotted the slight bubble of distortion as a cloaked figure slipped from the Darkhawk and traveled unnoticed and unhindered down the corridor. The alien's defense formation began to unravel from the rear as Rook began working his way up the lines, taking out the Grists one by one. Nearly half of the enemy was down before those in the front even noticed. By then, it was too late. Between Rook at the rear and Drav and Jid in the front, the whole defense disintegrated.
Rook!
Kemond called as he led the rest of the stormtroopers past the Grisk bodies.
Come on, Nogri. Give me a direction.
There was a flicker, and the diminutive creature reappeared.
This way,
he rumbled, gesturing with his electro staff.
I smell chiss. This way.
Kemond nodded briskly.
Veek, Dorstran, take point. Rook, hang behind them and call out directions. And keep that cloak on. If we need to throw you at them, I don't want them to even know you're there.
Understood,
Rook said. He did something to his chest and again vanished. Mentally, Kemond shook his head. Damn, but he wanted one of those.
Okay, stormtroopers. Move it out,
he ordered.
Let's show the Grand Admiral what the First Legion can do.
The Grist ship had been hit, disabled, and boarded. So far, Grand Admiral Thrawn's plan had gone exactly as predicted. Now, Pharaoh knew, came the real test.
Increased power emanations from bogies 1 and 2, Admiral,
Hammerly called briskly.
They've spotted the fight and are coming up to speed.
Very good, Thrawn said. TIE Commander, launch fighters in designated sequence.
Yes, sir!
Pharaoh looked at the tactical. 3 squadrons of TIE fighters were streaming from the Chimera's hangar bay now, expanding to full broadside formation and settling into 3 well-spaced waves. The 2 large Grisk ships were still coming to full combat readiness, but already they were reacting to the incoming ships, with Bogey 1 pulling back a bit, while Bogey 2 moved toward the TIEs. A maneuver that was clearly not lost on Thrawn.
TIE Commander, all ships on Bogey 2, he ordered. Wave 2, open fire as soon as you're in range.
Pharaoh frowned.
Wave 1 will be in range sooner, sir,
she pointed out quietly.
Indeed, Thrawn acknowledged. I have a theory, Commodore, which I wish to test.
The TIEs were still out of range when a pair of hatches opened on Bogey 2, and 2 ships the size of light cruisers appeared. They formed into a staggered pair and headed for the TIEs.
Interesting, Thrawn murmured. Notice, Commodore, how Bogeys 3 and 4 take up the same 4 back formation as the main ships themselves. Bogey 3 presents itself as the main target, while Bogey 4 remains slightly behind in reserve.
Yes, sir,
Pharaoh said, frowning. It was an obvious formation to take, one she'd seen dozens of times, hardly worth commenting on.
TIEs, target Bogey 3, Thrawn said. Repeat, target Bogey 3 only. Second wave only. Fire when ready.
The TIEs and cruisers continued closing on each other.
What about the defenders, sir?
Pharaoh prompted.
TIE Fighter Squadrons 4 and 5, stand ready,
Thrawn called in answer.
Defenders, stand ready. Lord Vader?
I am here, Admiral,
Vader's voice came.
I do not believe 3 waves of TIEs will be a match for the firepower of 2 light cruisers.
Nor do I, my lord. TIEs, hold your course.
Pharaoh took a deep breath. Thrawn was known for his efficiency, spending his troops with the care of a miser spending credits. But he was also known for his ruthlessness and his willingness to do whatever was necessary to achieve his objectives. Right now, Pharaoh couldn't tell which category this operation fell under. They were nearly at firing range. The Grisks were ready. A split second before the TIEs reached range, the lead cruiser opened fire, raking the front Imperial line with laser fire. 3 of the TIEs disintegrated in that opening salvo, another 2 staggering out of formation as each suffered the loss of a solar panel. An instant later, the second line of TIEs opened up with their own laser cannons, blazing across Bogey 3 as ordered, specifically targeting the cruiser's weapons clusters. The cruiser responded with another salvo, taking out 2 more of the first wave TIEs.
Break off, Thrawn snapped. All TIEs, break off and take evasive maneuvers back toward the Chimera.
He turned to Pharaoh, a small but satisfied smile touching his lips.
Did you see it, Commodore?
Pharaoh gazed at the tactical, her stomach tightening. What was Thrawn going for? That the cruisers had superior firepower? That the TIEs had caused only minimal damage to the lead cruiser's fighting capability?
I'm sorry, sir, she admitted. Apparently not.
All TIEs, launch, Thrawn ordered. 3 waves, defenders in wave 3. Form up with initial waves and await targeting orders.
He got acknowledgements and turned back to Pharaoh.
2 things, Commodore,
he said, lowering his voice.
First, the cruiser opened fire just before the TIEs reached their own range. What does that suggest?
Farrell looked again at the tactical, watching the TIEs and defenders stream out into the battlefield.
Thrawn had suggested earlier that the Grisks had been observing the Empire.
They're familiar with TIE firing range,
she said slowly.
They therefore let the TIEs get close enough so their own weapons would have maximum impact, but made sure they got the first volley.
Which means
that they know a great deal about Imperial weaponry, Farrow said,
as he'd already suggested.
Indeed, Thrawn said. And the second fact.
The two groups of standard TIEs and defenders had come together and were sorting themselves out as per Thrawn's orders.
I'm sorry, sir, Farrow confessed. I didn't see it.
You saw it, Commodore, Thrawn assured her. Which TIEs did the cruiser target?
Farrow frowned again. And then, suddenly she had it.
The Grisks targeted the first line, she said. But it was the second line that was firing at them.
Exactly, Thrawn said,
and there was no mistaking the satisfaction in his voice.
I had suspected that from our earlier encounters, but I needed confirmation. The Grisks' cultural blind spot is that they considered the nearest enemy to be the most dangerous, and will adjust their combat strategy to accommodate that bias.
And we just fed into that bias by attacking only the nearest of the two cruisers,
Farrow said, feeling a smile of her own touch her lips.
Exactly, Thrawn said again. And so we now have two weapons to use against them.
Two weapons, sir?
Thrawn looked out the forward viewport.
They think they know Imperial weaponry, Commodore, he said with quiet satisfaction. But they have never encountered a TIE defender.
According to the specs Sampa had shown him, Rook's vaunted personal invisibility cloak was supposed to last for 3 full minutes. In actuality, Keemond made a point of timing it, the thing popped him back out after 2 minutes and 20 seconds. And now the Legion's secret weapon was gone. Keemond scowled to himself as their formation continued down the maze of corridors. The ship was a lot bigger than the simple freighter they'd attacked before, with a lot more deck space and a lot more capacity for crew or passengers. And yet to this point, they hadn't run into much opposition. Either the Grisks had been caught by surprise and were still trying to organize a proper defense, or else they were simply biding their time and luring the stormtroopers into a trap. Keemond was pretty sure it would turn out to be the second.
Very near, Rook muttered.
As Keemond had picked up the Legion's pace, the Nogri had responded by dropping into a sort of primate run, loping along on all fours with his electrostaff strapped across his back. It made him look even more bestial than he already did.
Ahead, a Grisk popped out from the edge of a side compartment and blasted off a shot with his lightning gun, the bolt catching Jid on his right upper chest and staggering him back. Mortik swung her E-11 around and returned fire, but the Grisk had already ducked back out of sight. Mortik hurried forward, only to have the hatch close in front of her. Cursing under her breath, she dug into her utility pouch.
Belay that!
Keemond called to her, dropping to one knee beside Jid. As satisfying as it would be to blast the door and fry the Grisk, they didn't have the time to spare.
Just seal it and leave him there. Jid?
I'm okay, Commander,
Jid said, his voice coming out from between clenched teeth as Mortik gave the hatch control 2 point-blank blaster bolts.
Damn, but that stings!
Can you walk?
Keemond asked. Their earlier tangles with Grisk lightning guns had shown that a close-in shot could scramble a stormtrooper's muscles and nervous system, leaving him temporarily unable to function.
Not yet,
Jid growled.
Leave me here. I'll watch your back trail.
Keemond snarled a silent curse. The 10 stormtroopers he'd left the Chimera with were already down by 4. 2 left to guard the Darkhawk, and 2 more lost to enemy fire. If he now also had to leave Jid behind, they would be down to 5 stormtroopers and 1 Nogri. Half his force. And the Grists had yet to spring their main trap. Ellaby was obviously thinking along the same lines.
Sir, depending on what we find up ahead, we might end up taking a different route back to the Darkhawk.
He pointed out quietly.
If we leave them here, we may not be able to retrieve them when we're done.
Don't worry about it,
Jid said.
Go on, I'll catch up.
Sure,
Keeman said. Or else some Grisk would stroll up to him while he was unable to aim and take him out with a single leisurely shot. But there wasn't anything Keeman could do about it. He couldn't afford to leave another man behind to guard Jid while he recovered.
I could carry him,
Ellaby offered.
Carry me and shoot too?
Jid scoffed.
You're bad enough when it's just you and the firing range. Go! I'll be all right.
Right,
Keeman said reluctantly, leaving another man behind. But the mission had to come first.
Ellaby, you and Mortik are on point. Rook?
That corridor to the right,
the Nogri said, pointing ahead.
Let's go,
Keeman said. Letting Ellaby and Mortik get a 3-pace lead, he motioned Rook ahead and fell in behind him.
How the hell can he possibly know that?
Drav growled from behind Keeman as they headed out.
The air currents change,
Rook said over his shoulder as he again dropped to all fours.
The scent rides the currents.
Just make sure you don't mix up your directions,
Keeman warned.
We can't wander around the ship all day.
One corridor,
Rook promised. Mortik reached the corner and swung around it to the right, her E-11 ready. She paused a split second, then did a 180 to face the other way down the corridor.
Clear,
she murmured. She stayed in position as Ellaby rounded the corner beside her, bringing the long muzzle of his DLT-19 heavy blaster rifle around and leveling it to the right, the direction Rook had indicated.
One hatch, 20 meters directly ahead,
he reported.
Sealed. No side access.
There, Rook said. In that compartment.
Keeman muttered a curse. 20 meters of bare corridor, with no cover and nowhere to run? Traps couldn't get any more obvious. But he had his orders. Thrawn wanted the Chiss children out, and Vader hadn't disagreed. So that was what the First Legion was going to do.
Mortik, Drav, rear guard,
he ordered. Bad enough to be walking into a trap. No sense giving the enemy a chance to close in behind them, too.
Stay sharp.
He rounded the corner as Drav took up position with Mortik. The 2 stormtroopers standing back to back and watching the other approaches. Ellaby slipped into formation on Keeman's right and slightly behind him, while Sampa settled on Keeman's left. Rook was somewhere, but Keeman's full attention was on the hatch, and he didn't have time to check on where the Nogri might have gone. Mortik had been right. Bare corridor. No cover, no exit. Keeman glanced around, looking for signs of hidden gun ports, but the walls, ceiling, and deck seemed solid. It was just the hatch, then, which would presumably open at the Grisk's chosen time and unleash their carefully prepared firestorm. The First Legion made a point of keeping their armor in perfect condition, and as a result, it was usually able to block almost anything except a point-blank shot from a seriously and probably illegally enhanced blaster. Unfortunately, they'd already seen that the Grisk lightning bolts didn't have to penetrate the armor to take a stormtrooper out of the fight. In fact, Keeman decided, being left alive but unable to help as he watched his force gunned down in front of him, would be worse than being killed outright. And that was most likely the exact scenario that was about to unfold. Whether all the missing Grisks were waiting behind that hatch, or whether they were planning to waylay the stormtroopers on the way back to the Darkhawk, in the end, it would all add up the same. All for a couple of children. And not even Imperial children. Kemond was prepared to give his life for his stormtroopers, his commander, and his empire. He wasn't thrilled about giving it up for alien children. Curse Thrawn, anyway. They were three paces from the hatch, and Kemond had a door popper blasting cap ready in his hand, when the hatch suddenly slid open to reveal a triple line of Grists. Two lying prone, two kneeling, two standing. All six had their weapons leveled, and even as Kemond squeezed his E-11's trigger, the aliens opened fire at the stormtroopers. Or rather, they tried to. Even before the hatch was all the way open, the two prone gunners' weapons inexplicably jerked to either side. One left, one right. Their blasts arcing harmlessly into the corridor walls instead of their targets. A split second later, the two kneeling Grisks' heads simultaneously snapped backward, the backs of their helmets slamming into the torsos of the soldiers standing behind them. All four blasts also going wildly off target as their lightning guns were knocked out of line. And suddenly, Kemond got it.
Headshots!
He snapped at his men, shifting his aim to the leftmost standing Grisk. The alien, who had been starting to recover from the earlier impact against his torso, collapsed in a heap on the deck as two blaster bolts shattered his faceplate and sizzled through his skull. The two prone Grisks likewise went limp as Ellaby and Sampa fired simultaneous blaster bolts into their helmets. A blaster bolt sizzled past Keeman's helmet as Drab opened fire from the corridor intersection, dropping the remaining standing Grisk. The leftmost kneeling alien jerked to the side, his weapon twisting toward the ceiling. Kemond shifted his aim to the other kneeler and sent him flopping backward with his fellows. Before he could turn his E-11 toward the last Grisk, the alien's back twisted around and he fell to the deck. And then, to Kemond's complete lack of surprise, Rook popped back into sight, his electro staff still pressed against the last Grisk's throat. Kemond did a quick scan of the room behind the crumpled remains of the Grisk defense. It was a control area of some sort, its walls lined with consoles marked with curved arcs and circles of subdued light. In the center, half hidden behind a large console, a pair of blue-skinned Chiss girls were peeking anxiously toward him. There were no other hatches he could see in the compartment, and no more Grisk.
I thought your gadget was out of juice,
he said, as he stepped over the alien bodies and strode toward the children.
That was what I wanted you to think,
Rook said, falling into step beside him. Kemond sniffed, a whiff of burning skin making its way through his air system. Apparently, despite his attempt to keep the Nogri clear of the shooting by ordering headshots from his soldiers, Rook had caught the edge of one of the blaster bolts.
As I likewise wanted any Grisks monitoring our progress to assume.
Nicely done,
Kemond said, glancing at him. Now that he was looking, he could see a slight limp in the Nogri's right leg that hadn't been there before.
You okay?
I can travel, Rook said.
Traveling without getting gunned down would be nice too,
Kemond pointed out. The two children had stood up, but were still half hidden behind the console, as if that offered any real protection.
It's all right,
he called to them.
We're friends. Grand Admiral Thrawn sent us to rescue you.
Not even a flicker of response. Clearly this pair didn't understand basic either.
Come with us.
Kemond tried again anyway, beckoning them toward him.
Come on! We don't have all...
Abruptly, both girls' glowing red eyes widened. One of them half-turned and jabbed a finger toward a section of wall between two consoles. Kemond shifted his gaze, frowning as he followed her finger. A hidden gun port suddenly opened, and the muzzle of a lightning gun poked through. Cursing, Kemond swung his E-11 toward the gun port. but Sampa was already on it. Even as the lightning gun tracked toward the three stormtroopers, he sent two blaster shots into the opening. The lightning gun jerked, pointed briefly at the ceiling, then slid out of sight. Keenan turned back to the Chiss to see the other girl point suddenly at the wall behind her. This time, Keenan made sure his blaster was lined up with the gun port when it began to open, firing through it before the Grisk could even get his own weapon into position.
They see the future,
Rook grated.
So they do,
Keenan said, his lips curling back from his teeth in a macabre grin.
So they do.
He beckoned again.
Come on, kids. We're getting out of here.
He pointed at the two gun ports.
And you are going to point out every attack before it happens. Got it?
He held out his hand. Hesitantly, the two girls came out from behind the console. One of them looked at the outstretched hand.
Show them you're human,
Ellaby suggested. Holstering his E-11, Keenan pulled off his helmet and tucked it under his left arm.
See, he said, giving the girls his best smile. Not a Grisk. Not even a droid. Human.
Once again, he held out his hand. This time, the girl reached out and took it.
Move out,
Keenan ordered quietly, offering the second girl his other hand.
Draven Mortic at point. Chiss girls behind them. Ellaby and Sampa behind them. Rook and me at the rear. Vanguard and rear guard's job is to block any attack on the girls. Ellaby and Sampa's job is to have blasters lined up wherever the girls point. Let's go!
And as they maneuvered their way down the corridors, and the increasingly panicky Grisk attacks were steadily fought off or blocked practically before they could even be launched, a stray thought whispered through Keeman's mind. He could really, really get used to this kind of combat.
Commander Keenan, Admiral.
Keeman's voice came in Vader's helmet.
The Chiss prisoners have been recovered. Imperial forces have returned to the Darkhawk. Thank you, Commander.
Thrawn's voice came in response. A cool voice, Vader noted. A voice that was neither surprised nor impressed by the First Legion's success. Because that was, after all, simply what Thrawn had ordered and expected them to do.
And now the Grisks have lost the ability to navigate across unfamiliar regions.
Do you want us to destroy the ship before we leave it, sir?
Keenan asked.
Unnecessary,
Thrawn said.
It is sufficiently disabled to keep from further combat. And I have need of the Darkhawk's resources elsewhere.
Yes, sir,
Keenan said.
Casting off now.
Well done, Commander,
Thrawn continued.
And now, Lord Vader, you may prepare for your attack. The enemy believe themselves superior to Imperial forces. Let us prove them wrong.
We shall. Defender Squadron, form up on me.
And so the children were safe. Force-sensitive Chiss children, alive and well. Mentally, Vader shook his head. All those private meetings. All those secret conversations. All his personal misgivings about what Thrawn and the Emperor were doing. But he realized now that he had nothing to fear. Thrawn's loyalties would always be split between the Empire and his own people. A fact the Emperor undoubtedly knew. No matter how high Thrawn rose in the ranks of the military, he would never have the necessary standing to challenge Vader's position at the Emperor's side.
Lord Vader, you will lead the Defender Squadron as Wave 3,
Thrawn continued.
You will match speed and firepower with the TIEs, and you will not use missiles or shields until cleared to do so.
Acknowledged,
Vader said. Captain Skerris had argued long and hard against that part of the plan. Long enough and hard enough that Vader would have sent him to his knees had the man been under his command. Thrawn had been more patient and forgiving. Briefly, Vader wondered if the pilot's attitude would someday come back against him.
All TIEs, attack!
Thrawn ordered.
Take out the cruisers and engage Bogey 2.
Acknowledge,
the TIE commander said.
All right, Imperials. Grand Admiral Thrawn wants to see carnage. Let's make some.
The TIEs leapt forward, sweeping toward the Grisk ships at full power. Vader let the first two waves pass, then drew his Defender squadron in behind them. The first attack had been a test. A free shot Thrawn had offered the Grisks in order to confirm his analysis of their tactics. This time, the enemy was going to have to work a lot harder for prizes. Even as the cruisers opened fire, the TIEs veered off their vectors, swerving to the sides and reforming in pairs to swarm the cruisers. And every attack the cruisers launched was at the leading fighter of each pair. Vader nodded to himself. So Thrawn had been right about the Grisk's tactical pattern. Now, with the cruisers fully engaged, it was time to see whether or not they could change that pattern.
Defenders, TIE 4, follow me,
he ordered. Sweeping up and over the cruisers, he drove his defender out of the battle and turned toward Bogey 2, the lead Grisk ship. Around him, the other defenders arranged themselves into a broadside as the 4th TIE squadron swept through their formation and formed up in front of them.
Admiral?
Vader called.
I place the defenders under your command, my lord,
Thrawn said.
You may act on your own discretion.
Once, Vader reflected, he might have considered that an off-handed comment. A veiled hint that this part of the mission wasn't important enough for the Grand Admiral to bother with personally. But having watched Thrawn's interactions with Commodore Farrow, and having heard him give her an almost identical order, he knew now that wasn't the case. What Thrawn was telling Vader was that he trusted him to command that part of the operation. Whether a Chiss's trust for a Sith Lord was a subtle insult wasn't really the point. And Vader didn't think any insult was intended anyway. The Jedi had seen enough of Thrawn's style and way of speaking to understand that that was simply how he was.
Very well, Admiral. TIE 4, prepare to veer off. Defenders, prepare to raise shields and go to full speed.
Bogey 2 was looming ahead. This time, the larger ship didn't wait until the TIEs were nearly to their own range before opening fire. Their lasers lashed out.
Veer off. Evasive and attack. Defenders, mark gun ports.
Bogey 2 fired again and again and again. The TIEs swept over and passed, dodging the lasers and returning fire as best and as accurately as they could. Two more were hit, disintegrating into flaming debris. Vader gave the Grisks one more volley. And as that final blaze of laser fire lanced out from the big ship, he finally had all the data he needed.
TIEs, pull back. Defenders, shields and full power. Go!
He keyed the shields and pulled the throttle all the way back. A Dark Lord of the Sith never gasped in surprise. But if Vader had been anything else, he would have. Certainly the Jedi would have reacted as he was jammed back into his seat. Only in Vader's prototype TIE Advanced X-1 had he ever felt such power at a fighter before. Or the incredible balance between speed and nimbleness. A laser burst blazed straight at him. It sizzled into nothingness, its only effect being a brief wave of luminosity flickering around the edge of the defender's shield. And with that, Vader knew they had won.
All defenders, attack. Clear out the gun emplacements. TIE 4, form up again and move into the spots we've cleared. Darkhawk, come in behind TIE 4. Concentrate on anything that looks like a cruiser or a fighter hatch. If there are other enemy ships, I want them to remain inside.
He took a deep breath, listening to the chorus of acknowledgements. The feel of a fighter. The thrill and burden and satisfaction of command. But those were the Jedi's memories. not his. Another laser bolt splashed off his shields. Arming a missile, he sent it into the center of the emplacement. A flare of fire and debris blew into space. He armed a second missile, chose his target, and fired. Then, right at the edge of the Defender's sensors, back behind the main Grisk warships, Vader spotted another ship. Small, courier-sized, unlike any of the configurations he'd yet seen, doing its best to sneak away. He looked back at the battle. Among the Chimera, Darkhawk, Defenders, and Standard TIEs, the Grisks were minutes from defeat, their defenses crumbling in front of him. From this point on, Vader and his fighter would neither add to nor detract from that inevitability. Turning his Defender onto an intercept course, he set off in pursuit. Someone from the Chimera called his name, once, then a second, more urgent time. He ignored both hails. The mystery ship had spotted him now, but instead of turning to engage, it increased its speed, heading toward deep space. The Defender slowly but steadily closed the gap. But the timing was too short. The other ship's lead too big. Long before Vader reached firing distance, the ship escaped into hyperspace. For a long moment, Vader gazed at the spot where it had disappeared, the possibilities and implications churning together through his mind. Then, turning the Defender around, he headed back toward the battle. The Imperials would win the day, and then he and Thrawn would have a talk. A very long, very serious talk.
Bogey 2 fully engaged, Pharaoh reported.
Her voice holds new confidence, and her stance holds eagerness.
Bogey 1 is pulling back.
Acknowledged, Commodore, Thrawn said. Move the Chimera to attack Bogey 1. Maintain distance from Bogey 2.
Because as long as the TIEs are attacking Bogey 2, they're its main threat, Pharaoh murmured.
Her voice holds understanding. Indeed, Thrawn said. You wondered earlier how we would defeat two ships nearly as large as ours. You now have an answer.
Yes, sir,
Pharaoh said. Her voice holds grim anticipation.
We persuade them to let us take them on one at a time.
Very good, Thrawn said. Move the Chimera into position and commence attack.
Defender 4, there is an emplacement to starboard of the weapon Defender 6 destroyed.
Vader's voice came over the speaker.
The voice is different, but it holds the same intensity and focus. The word patterns are different, but the cadence and intonation are the same. The brashness has abated, but the firm sense of loyalty is the same.
Sir?
Pharaoh asked tentatively.
Yes, Commodore.
Sorry, sir.
Pharaoh's voice holds apology and concern.
The way you were looking out at Bogey 1. Are you all right, sir?
I am, Thrawn said. I was pondering the problem of mixed loyalties and the decisions one must sometimes make. Lieutenant Lomar, hail the Grisks.
Yes, sir.
The comm officer's voice holds no confusion or concern, but he is not as astute as Commodore Pharaoh.
Ready, Admiral?
Grisk war vessel. This is Admiral Mithron Yerodo,
Thrawn said in Mieskalf.
You are hereby delivered notice to return to your homeworlds and abandon your ambitions to extend your rule beyond your borders. If you continue in these endeavors, be assured that you will be defeated and destroyed. There is no response, but the Grisk silence holds anger and malice. End transmission,
he said in basic.
Sir?
Pharaoh's voice holds caution.
May I ask?
I gave my name and warned them to cease operations against us.
Thrawn said.
Ah.
Pharaoh's expression holds confusion.
I assume you're not expecting them to listen?
The survivors of this battle may take the warning to heart,
Thrawn said.
Their masters, unfortunately, will not.
I see.
Pharaoh looks out the viewport. Her stance and expression hold determination.
Well then, when they come for us, we'll beat them too.
Vader's defender continues to sweep around Bogey 2, alternating between missile and laser cannon fire. He spins the fighter in a tight curve and heads back toward another target, doing a complete roll as he does so. It is a familiar maneuver, carried out with a familiar precision. It is he. Without warning, he veers off, heading from the battle zone toward an escaping ship. Tie Control calls to him once, then twice, but he's ignored. The configuration of the ship Vader is pursuing.
I admire your confidence, Commodore, Thrawn said. Let us hope that confidence is not unwarranted.
Yes, sir, Pharaoh said. But I'm not concerned. We have you, and we have Lord Vader. Whatever the Grisks throw at us, we can take it.
She straightens up, her determination increasing.
Starting with this group right here. Turbo lasers! You saw where the Bogey 2 gun ports were. Start by targeting the same positions on Bogey 1.
Epilogue. Then. The Cortosis miners who shuffled back to the surface at Lebjow's order were, for the most part, fearful, or angry, or just hesitant. But they did come out, all of them. They filed past Lebjow, Thrawn, and Padme, throwing glances at Anakin as he moved back and forth between the equipment sheds, collecting the tools and explosives necessary for destroying the mine. A few of the miners tried to ask Lebjow what was going on, or to accuse him of collaborating with their oppressors. But for the most part, their anger or fear quickly faded into a weary resignation.
I don't think General Skywalker has thought this through,
Thrawn murmured to Padme as the final group of miners walked past and headed toward the battered vehicles in the parking area. His expression was uneasy, and Padme could hear the disapproval beneath the tone.
It would be better to allow the Separatists to waste their resources than to force them to look elsewhere.
I agree,
Padme said, feeling a twinge of guilt with each dejected-looking miner who passed.
But I've seen Anakin in this mood.
She looked sideways at him.
I'm guessing you have, too.
Indeed, Thrawn said. But he has feelings for you. Can you not persuade him to rethink this action?
What do you mean?
Padme asked, the all-too-familiar mix of innocence and disclaimer springing reflexively to her lips.
I understand your reticence,
Thrawn said.
But the time for that has passed. I've observed you both, and I know what you're hiding. General Skywalker's plan could create a serious threat to this world. You must stop him.
Padme shook her head, her thoughts flashing back to that terrible day. That terrible frozen moment when Anakin had confessed his slaughter of the Sand People. He won't listen to me,
she said, blinking back tears.
Once he's decided something, he won't listen to anyone.
Thrawn was silent a moment.
Then there's indeed nothing we can do.
Padme looked at him. There'd been something new in his voice.
Is there a problem?
She asked.
I mean, another problem?
There is no problem,
Thrawn said.
But my task here is complete. If you'll again loan me your communicator, I'll take leave of you and your...
He glanced at Anakin.
Your associate.
Of course,
Padme said, slipping off her backpack. She dug out her comm and handed it to him.
Thank you,
he said, keying it on and tapping out a short code.
This has been an interesting experience, Ambassador Padme. I trust that both our peoples have gained from our brief alliance. Any chance I can persuade you to return to Coruscant with us? To speak with Supreme Chancellor Palpatine?
She asked as she took the comm back and put it away.
Our peoples should get to know each other. There's a great deal we could accomplish together.
I'm afraid I have other duties I must attend to, Thrawn said. In addition, I'm not in a position to take part in official communications.
His eyes flicked over her shoulder.
General Skywalker, I must take my leave.
I understand,
Anakin said. Padme turned, wincing at the bundle of wrapped explosives he had put together.
But you really should reconsider Padme's offer. The Republic's going to win this war, and Chancellor Palpatine is the one who'll lead us to that victory. The Chiss Ascendancy would do well to establish good relations with him.
Perhaps someday, Thrawn said. But for now, I must depart.
He looked up. Padme followed his gaze. Above them, a dark shape was dropping toward the ground.
I'll wait in orbit until you depart to guard against further attacks,
Thrawn continued as a sleek ship settled to the ground nearby.
Safe travels to you both.
I hope we'll meet again,
Padme said.
Thank you for your help.
And for yours,
Thrawn said, inclining his head to her. The ship's ramp lowered as he walked toward it, the hatch behind it sliding open. He walked to the ramp
and paused.
One final thought, he said, turning to face them. I'm concerned by your suggestion that the Separatists plan to infiltrate your government offices disguised in enhanced clone armor. Successful attacks of that sort generally require numbers that the Separatists will have difficulty placing into position.
There are a lot of clones wandering around the Senate and Chancellery,
Padme said.
But a single massive infiltration draws attention, while gradual infiltration holds the risk of premature discovery,
Thrawn pointed out.
I cannot help but wonder if the armor is intended for some other purpose.
Was intended,
Anakin said, leaning on the word.
Was. Whatever Solha and Dooku were planning, it's no longer relevant.
Perhaps, Thrawn said. Still, it would be wise to think on it, General.
Turning again, he walked up the ramp and disappeared inside. The hatch and ramp sealed, and the ship rose again into the sky.
You think he could be right?
Padme asked, suppressing a shiver. There was something in Thrawn's earnestness that had sent a darkness through her.
I don't know, Anakin said. And right now, I don't care. Get back to the ship, and make sure it's ready. I'll set this thing, and we'll get out of here.
Anakin.
But he was already gone. With one last lingering look up at the stars, Padme headed back to their borrowed ship. Lebjow met her at the ramp.
I was hoping I could hitch a ride somewhere, he said.
You aren't going back to your people?
Padme asked, frowning.
You mean the people who'll probably hang me if I stay?
He countered bitterly.
It's not that bad,
Padme said, trying to sound positive.
Most of the workers at the factory will be able to go back. They'll still need you to work on the super battle droid assembly line.
If the Duke lets us,
Lebjow said.
Fair chance he won't. Especially...
He broke off, waving a hand at the mine buildings.
Even if he does, the miners aren't going to get their jobs back.
This is war.
The old cliched phrase came automatically to Padme's mind. But this wasn't Mokivja's war. Or it hadn't been, until they'd been dragged into it. The fact that it was the Separatists who'd done the dragging and not the Republic was small consolation. It wouldn't be any consolation at all to Lebjow's people.
I know,
she said quietly.
I'm sorry,
she sighed.
Yes, of course you can come with us. Would Batuu work? We have to go there anyway to get my ship.
Sure,
Lepjow said, his eyes still on the mine.
I know some guys who went there once. Sounded okay.
If you know people who go there, it might be wise to change your name.
Yeah, no big deal.
He waved at the ship.
I don't suppose I can have that ship when you're done with it. I know it's stolen, but it doesn't sound like people on Batuu would care. I could probably sell it for a steak.
Of course you can have it,
Padme said.
It's the least we can do.
She craned her neck as Anakin reappeared at the mine entrance.
Here he comes.
Okay,
Anakin said, hurrying up to them.
Into the ship. Lepjow, you need to get clear.
We're taking him to Batuu,
Padme interrupted. Anakin flashed her a frown, shifted the frown to Lepjow.
Okay, sure. In that case, both of you into the ship.
3 minutes later, they were half a kilometer in the air, hovering a kilometer away from the mine-building cluster.
10 seconds, Anakin warned. Though there shouldn't be much to see.
What's supposed to happen?
Padme asked.
I'm just collapsing the tunnels, Anakin said. There should be some ground fracturing, maybe some dust.
An instant later, the area exploded into a blazing geyser of fire and smoke. Padme gasped as Anakin twisted the control yoke hard over, trying to get them away from the geyser. Something slapped into the ship's underside, throwing a slight wobble into his maneuver, and a few blazing embers landing on the hull near the cockpit viewport.
What the frost is that?
Lepjow yelped.
I don't know.
Anakin snapped back, fighting the controls as more globs slammed into both the upper and lower edges of the ship.
Don't give me I don't know,
Lepjow snarled.
That's my world down there. What the frost did you do?
I just collapsed the tunnels,
Anakin said. The ship was leveling off now, outside the edge of the roiling fountain still pouring from the mine.
It shouldn't. Look, I've taken down mines before. I know how to do it.
But this isn't just a mine,
Padme said, staring at the biggest of the glowing globs on the ship's hull as she suddenly understood.
It's a Cortosis mine.
What is that?
Anakin broke off.
No. That's crazy. It's only supposed to redirect blaster energy.
I guess it can redirect the heat of explosives, too,
Padme bit out, her stomach tightening into a painful knot.
That's lava out there, Anakin. However the Cortosis did it, it sent your explosion straight down through the crust into the magma.
For a long moment, none of them said anything. There was nothing to say.
Doesn't look like it's coming too close to your town,
Padme said at last. Even to herself, the attempt at solace sounded pitiful.
It's blowing away from the factory, too.
No, it's just pouring lava onto our best cropland,
Lepjow said bitterly.
And that ash and smoke, it's gonna be in the air and cropland and water for years. Maybe forever.
Padme looked at Anakin. His jaw was set, his eyes focused straight ahead.
Collateral damage.
The other cliché came to her mind.
Collateral damage.
A planet full of people, just trying to live their lives. The kind of ordinary civilians she and Anakin had once dedicated themselves to protecting.
Collateral damage.
And it hadn't started here, either. She'd been doing it ever since she arrived on Mokivja. She'd cajoled and bribed and all but insisted that Lepjow and his friends work for her, that they risk everything for this stranger who dropped into their midst.
Collateral damage.
Had she become so numbed and war-weary that she no longer even saw what she was doing to everyone else around her?
But I guess there's nothing we could do about it now,
Lepjow continued. The bitterness was gone, leaving only tiredness behind.
I'll talk to the Senate,
Padme promised.
We'll talk to the Senate,
she amended, looking at Anakin.
Maybe they can send some help.
Anakin didn't reply. But then he knew as well as she did that the words were meaningless. The Senate had far too many demands on its limited resources to even notice Makivcha, let alone help its people.
Collateral damage.
Yeah,
Lebjow said. He wasn't fooled either.
Can we get out of here now?
Sure,
Anakin said.
Batu?
It's as good a place as any to start a new life,
Lebjow said. His eyes, Padme noted, were still on the magma geyser.
You can always try the Black Spire Cantina,
Anakin said.
I'm guessing they go through a lot of bartenders at that place.
Sure,
Lebjow said.
I'll think about it.
Epilogue. Now. The Chiss warship drifted away from the Chimera and turned back onto its original vector. A moment's pause, then with a flicker of pseudo-motion, it was gone. For a moment, Vader gazed out the main viewport after it. The ship wasn't nearly as big as a Star Destroyer, but from what he'd seen of its flank-side weapons, it would be a formidable opponent. He sensed Thrawn's presence behind him before he heard the soft footsteps on the command walkway.
All is well?
He asked the Chiss.
All is well, Thrawn said. Admiral Arilani will return the children to their families, and has promised to bolster the defenses of the colony world from which they were taken.
Yes. The time has come, Admiral.
The time?
You promised proof that the Grisks are a threat to the Empire.
Vader turned to face Thrawn.
If such proof does indeed exist...
It awaits us in my office,
Thrawn assured him.
At your convenience.
Vader strode past him down the walkway, his cloak swirling. Thrawn's office was off the rear of the aft bridge. Stretching out with the Force to wave the door open, he walked inside. Lying in the middle of the desk, taking up half the available space, was a section of half-disassembled machinery.
This is the proof,
he demanded, as Thrawn closed the door and crossed to the other side of the desk.
It is, my lord. It is the inner power coupling mechanism for one of the Grisk gravity projectors. Note the meshwork wrapping the three poles and linking to the shield shell.
Vader frowned. The material looked familiar. He stiffened.
Cortosis.
Indeed,
Thrawn said.
This is what the Grisks use the material for. Power couplings and energy management. It cannot dissipate the sharp power gradient of their arc cannon weaponry, as you saw, and so is of no use to them as armor.
How does that prove Grisk interference with the Empire?
I propose two questions. First, how did the Grisks know that Cortosis would be an effective defense against blasters and lightsabers?
Vader stared at the Cortosis weave, more of the Jedi's memories seeping back into his consciousness.
You suggest they were studying us as far back as the Clone Wars?
I do, my lord.
A small smile touched the Chiss's face.
After all, the Chiss were watching you. Why not the Grisks? My second question. Once the Grisks knew the value of Cortosis against blasters and lightsabers, how did the Separatists gain that knowledge?
Vader reached out and touched the edge of the Cortosis with a gloved finger.
So many dark, dark memories.
You suggest the Grisks contacted Dooku, that they offered him invulnerable battle droids as a way to ensure Separatist victory.
Indeed,
Thrawn said. I believe their plan was to offer him a taste of such a victory, then withhold it until they had obtained his servitude. But he surprised them.
In what way?
We have now seen the Grisk pattern of dominance, my lord, Thrawn said. On Batuu, they forced the Darshi into obedience by holding their ceremonial daggers hostage. With the Chiss, they are attempting to do the same by taking our children. Stealing one species' treasured and honored past, stealing another species' treasured and vital future. But Dooku surprised them. Instead of simply armoring battle droids, he armored both droids and clone armor. I believe that it was that surprise, and the further reconsideration it forced upon them, that delayed the Grisk's movement into the Empire until now.
Yes, Vader murmured.
Only it wasn't Dooku who'd created that plan. What Vader knew now, what the Jedi had never known, was that the factory was being secretly overseen by Chancellor Palpatine, who saw in the Cortosis an extra guarantee of success for his upcoming Order 66.
You said before that they were sealing themselves away.
I was wrong. Or rather, my conclusion was incomplete. I believe now that they are ready to make their move, and that the purpose of sealing off the region around Batuu is to discourage Imperial travel there while they take their final steps toward learning how to manipulate humans the way they have the Darshi and the Chiss.
Why can it not be both? They seek to isolate Batuu for study and also close all convenient avenues the Empire might use to move against them. Their observations of Clone War battles and subsequent Imperial operations will have taught them that our preferred strategy is to bring large numbers of ships and overwhelming force to bear.
Indeed, Thrawn said thoughtfully. Yes. Their own combat pattern, according to legend, is to use many small groups of warships, each group composed of only a few vessels. It is a strategy designed for infiltration over a large area instead of immediate massive conquest.
Especially when such infiltration is accompanied by reluctant allies among their target's populace.
Indeed. Thrawn's eyes took on a new intensity. You may recall my suggestion that using the Cortosis clone armor for infiltration would not be an effective tactic for the Separatists to use against the Republic. In retrospect, that could indicate the hand of the Grisks in molding that particular Separatist strategy.
Vader stared at him.
He knew. You made no such suggestion to me,
he said. A hollow gesture, but one he had to make.
Ah, Thrawn said, and Vader sensed a subtle shift in his thoughts.
Doubt? Confirmation?
My error. I was thinking of an incident from my past. My point remains, the Grisks stand ready to begin their infiltration of the Empire. The only solution is to eliminate the threat before they are fully prepared.
And there it was. The reason, perhaps merely the justification, for dealing with the Grand Admiral right here and now. Treason, overt or subtle, was grounds for execution.
So you propose spending Imperial resources against the Grisks, thereby protecting your own Chiss ascendancy at the expense of the Empire?
You question my loyalty,
Thrawn said. It was a statement, not a question.
I do,
Vader said, eyeing the Grand Admiral's throat. A quick twist, a snapping of the neck.
You misunderstand, my lord,
Thrawn said quietly.
Have you listened to the transmission I sent the Grisk ship? The message I knew would be passed on by the survivors of the battle.
Would that make a difference?
Thrawn reached to his computer and pressed a few keys.
Grisk war vessel. This is Admiral Mithron, your order.
The Mees Kauf words came from the computer speaker.
You are hereby delivered notice to return to your homeworlds and abandon your ambitions to extend your rule beyond your borders. If you continue in these endeavors, be assured that you will be defeated and destroyed.
Thrawn touched another key, and the recording ended. He looked at Vader, waiting. Vader ran the words over again in his mind, and then he saw it.
You identified yourself as Mithron Nerodo,
he said quietly.
A Chiss name. And the Grisks always attack the closer enemy first.
Yes, Thrawn said, and Vader sensed a fresh layer of emotion in his voice. The invasion is coming, Lord Vader. But I have now bought the Empire time to prepare.
Perhaps. But that is not all of it.
Thrawn's eyes narrowed slightly. What do you mean?
You know exactly what I mean.
Vader gestured toward the bulkhead and the galaxy beyond it.
I saw the ship, Admiral. The ship that escaped from the battle.
He paused, but Thrawn didn't respond.
I presume from your silence that you saw it as well. It was a courier ship. A Chiss courier ship.
Perhaps you were mistaken.
No. There is more. The personal cloaking device worn by the Grisks, identical in function to that used by your assassin, Rook. I submit they are all of Chiss design.
For another moment, Thrawn remained silent. Then he took a slow, measured breath.
Yes. Though, ironically, such devices are of no use to our own people. Yes, it was a Chiss shuttle you saw, my lord. But my message to the Grisks and its importance to the Empire still remain.
Do they? Was your message to warn the Grisks away from the Empire? Or was it a warning to whatever group of Chiss are working with them that you are aware of their presence?
Thrawn smiled faintly, but Vader could sense the pain behind the smile.
Why can it not be both?
Was it both?
Thrawn turned away.
There were stirrings of political conflict when I left my people for the Empire those many years ago. I assumed the aristocrats would settle their differences, as they have so many times before. This time perhaps they could not. Or perhaps the Grisks have made deeper inroads into our culture than I'd hoped.
Vader gazed at the Chiss, feeling the dark irony deep within him.
So you, who have never hidden your contempt for the Republic's handling of the Clone Wars, now stand on the edge of your own civil war?
Or have already taken our first steps into it? If one side is already under control of the Grisks...
He shook his head.
Your earlier thought was perhaps closer to the mark than you knew. Perhaps the true purpose of closing the border is to prevent me from bringing the Empire against them.
It was, Vader thought, an intensely arrogant suggestion. Still, having seen Thrawn's abilities, he could well believe that someone would want to keep him away from their plans.
What do you intend to do about it?
Meaning?
Time is likely critical for your people,
Vader said.
Will you turn your back on the Emperor and take the Chimera to your worlds to assist in their survival?
I hardly think that would be possible,
Thrawn said, turning back to face him.
You certainly would oppose such a decision.
Do you expect me to believe that a tactician of your skill has not yet thought of a way to kill me?
Another faint smile.
I have. In fact, thought of three ways.
The smile faded.
I pledge myself to serve the Emperor, Lord Vader, just as I once pledged to assist Anakin Skywalker. Someday, I will indeed return to my people. But not until the threats to the Empire have been dealt with.
For a long moment, they stood together in silence. Vader thought about his secret, about Thrawn's loyalty, about the Emperor's continued need for him,
perhaps the entire Empire's need for him.
Anakin Skywalker is dead.
Thrawn lowered his head.
I know.
Vader nodded slowly.
I know.
Not so I have heard. Not so I was informed. But I know.
We will not speak of him again. You will not speak of him again.
I understand, my lord. But I will always honor his legacy.
For another moment, Vader was silent.
I'm told you believe the Navy should focus on small fighter craft.
A flicker of something crossed Thrawn's face.
I do, my lord.
The Defender is an excellent ship. I will speak to the Emperor on behalf of the project.
He raised a finger.
But it needs to be faster and more heavily armed.
He considered.
The controls, too, should also be made simpler. Not all Imperial pilots are as capable as Captain Skerris.
Or as yourself, Thrawn said, inclining his head. Excellent suggestions. I will transmit those instructions to the Lothal facility upon our return to Coruscant.
Good. Are we done here?
Thrawn lowered his head in a respectful bow.
Yes, Lord Vader. We are done.
This is Mark Thompson. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Star Wars, Thrawn, Alliances, by Timothy Zahn. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson. Executive producer, Nick Martorelli. Star Wars Thrawn Alliances is a production of Lucasfilm Limited and registered or trademarked where indicated. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved. Used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music Master Production Copyright 2007. Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Penguin Random House audio presentation. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.